This episode is brought to you by Quarter. Quarter is revolutionizing how investors listen to earnings calls and conduct due diligence. It's basically Spotify, but for investors. With Quarter, you can effortlessly search for any company and quickly gain access to their latest earnings calls, M&A announcements, and capital markets days. Plus, it's all absolutely free. Quarter constantly improves its product, and its latest update is no exception. Today, you can search for keywords like free cash flow yield or return on invested capital, and Quarter instantly indexes every company transcript that matches that key phrase. It's incredible. I'm excited to watch the Quarter team roll out more features to make my job as an investor even easier. And Quarter is one of the few apps I use every single day. I know you will too once you download it. So head on over to quarter.com. Download the free app on either Android or iPhone and start using it today. That's quarter.com on the Android or iPhone store, and you'll wonder how you ever invested without it. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as Matimco, the investment office of MIT. Each year, Matimco invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays Matimco has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. Matimco also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit matimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The Matimco team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. I'm also excited to announce Tegas. Tegas has the world's largest collection of instantly available interviews on all the public and private companies you care about. All you have to do is log in and type in a stock ticker or a keyword. For example, if you're interested in gaming stocks, you can type in RBLX for Roblox, or type in the keyword metaverse and instantly read hundreds of calls on the company and industry. Tegas actually makes primary research fun and effortless too. Instead of weeks and months, you can learn a new industry or company in hours, and all from those that know it best. Now, I only sponsor products that I use every day, and Tegas is no exception. Since joining, I spend nearly all my time reading Tegas calls on existing companies and new ideas into my portfolio, and I know you will too. So if you're interested, head on over to tegas.co/valuehive for a free trial to see for yourself. Again, that's tegas.co/valuehive. All right, Paul, you've had quite the journey as a investor in microcaps, small caps, implementing both fundamental and some canned slim technical analysis tricks of the trade. These last 2 years have been very difficult. So if you can identify the most difficult parts in your investing journey over these last 2 years, what were they? And how difficult were they compared to other times in your investing journey?
I've been at it for so long now that the curveballs that the markets or the world sort of throws you every now and then seem to be a little less dangerous than the ones before. But as far as the last couple of years, obviously with the pandemic and things, it does change the way you sort of do business. I missed the ability to sort of get in people's faces, right? Get do site visits, get in front of management, see their body language and things like that. So that's made it a little bit more challenging. I've had to learn how to work with Zoom and all sorts of things that I didn't have to before that. So so there's been some trials and tribulations that way, but really, kind of what we do or what I do as a process hasn't really changed that much. The last 2 years have been pretty volatile. They've, you sort of wonder what's going to happen next. But ultimately, the fundamentals of what I do haven't really changed. So, but it's been quite the journey for sure.
Now, one of the things that I haven't asked a microcap investor since kind of the COVID pandemic was the benefit, quote unquote, to some of these microcaps is the illiquidity. And I wonder how that played out during the COVID pandemic and kind of that panic sell-off. What were some of the volume and liquidity aspects of a microcap portfolio that maybe held up, where people just didn't sell simply because they couldn't, or they didn't want to sell? Or did you see like an inbound in liquidity once this panic set in?
I think, you know, for one thing, you had to throw out your sort of business manuals and your economy 101 lessons, because it was really the first time for something like this for most of us investors, right? So it was a challenge to kind of understand what was going to happen next. And when it comes to microcaps, yeah, liquidity, I like the way you put it, the benefit of low liquidity, because if you're a buyer, I tend to be more predisposed to buying than selling. And sometimes it's very difficult to buy positions in some of the microcaps you really like. And when everybody else is panicking, this is where you decide if you're really meant for this business or not. You're there trying to accumulate and take advantage of the extra liquidity on the sell side. So, one thing I'll say about the sort of the panic that I saw, I was amazed at how fast it sort of played out. I think nobody was sitting there saying, okay, you know, the next 6 months or next 12 months is going to be one of the best microcap markets we're going to have in our lifetime.
Right.
So, you know, the challenge of understanding what was happening while it was happening was quite difficult. But for me, you know, it allowed me to add some positions, and it allowed me to sort of shake off some positions that I was questioning, because, you know, at that point you really wanted to sort of have some quality and be able to have some conviction in some of the names you had, right?
I remember, I think it was Dave Waters who gave a story about he had this like stink bid in some crazy, mm-hmm. highly illiquid microcap mm-hmm. name, and he got filled or something, I think, over COVID. Maybe I'm butchering the story, but those things always interest me, where let's say a stock's trading at 100 and it's super liquid. Mm-hmm. So you put a stink bid in at 50 or 45 and never mm-hmm. expecting it to get hit. And then all of a sudden you check your brokerage statement. It's like, oh, like I now own that at that price that I never thought I would be able to buy it at.
Yeah. Well, that sort of reminds me of a story. It wasn't so much the pandemic, but I think it was 87 or 1989. We had the flash crash.
Yep.
And I remember seeing, you know, quite liquid names, you know, in the sort of the small cap, not even micro cap, but some true small caps. They were going no bid. Like there were no bids on some of these stocks that were trading, you know, hundreds of thousands of shares. And there was one case where the stock that I really loved, it was trading around $12, $13, and it went no bid. And I threw in a bid at $3, and lo and behold, I get filled.
Wow.
2 days later, the stock back at $9, $10. Wow. And so, I mean, one of the benefits of being old and at this for a long time, like I have, is that you get scar tissue, you get muscle memory, you get whatever you want to call it. And you've been through so many things that you tend to, it's like that fireman who's, you know, been in, you know, hundreds of burning buildings, that the next burning building is not going to be as scary as the last one. So, you know, we've got the benefit of having lived through some crazy times in the past.
I think the other fascinating thing about microcaps and like liquidity events like that is it's easier to wrap your head around who might be selling to you or whom might be selling to you than mm-hmm. say these bigger names where it's just a bunch of institutions trading fund flows with one another. It could very well be like a wealthy individual that wants to buy a new boat or wants to buy a new house. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. he's just driving all this liquidity to the market. And you're like, oh, like, okay. Like, I guess I'll buy
yeah.
some.
Yeah. So that's the beauty of the microcap side. There's so many little things that really, when you take it from a buyer's standpoint, there's so many advantages, because just that, you know, they can be influenced by somebody who has to sell, right? And yes, you get it in the institutional side with bigger names and things like that, but there's other institutions that can be on the buy side. Usually in a microcap, some of the buyers get pretty scarce, and if somebody has to liquidate, you can see some real serious mispricing. So if you're prepared, that's when you get pretty excited.
The other advantage I think you have intrinsically versus other retail investors or even professional investors is the fact that you've been a CEO of companies. And I believe you've taken a company public at least one, maybe two companies public. Is that true?
Well, it's actually, I've almost lost count. So years and years ago, I actually took two companies public. Two companies public. I've been involved in startups where, you know, some stayed private, some went public. I've been a CEO of a couple of public companies. I'm currently a CEO of one. All of that is fantastic experience because you really learn what goes on behind the scenes. You learn what the pieces are to get something to be successful. And quite frankly, you learn how hard it is, right? It looks so easy when it's successful and people are kind of doing the right things, but there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes. And as far as really what it's done for me as an investor is, appreciate for one thing, when somebody's doing it right, you really appreciate, you know, what they're going through. But you also understand the other things that you don't see. Most investors maybe see 10% of really what goes on with a business, a public company, but there's another 90% that you really don't get an opportunity to see and understand, maybe where the minefields are or when something's going right, you might identify it sooner. You know, the psyche of some CEOs and management teams, you don't understand if you haven't been in there. So I think all that experience helps. I think one of the things investors really have to, take to this business is their experience. I think anybody who's run a business, whether it's public or not, you have some skill sets that others that haven't, aren't able to use as investors. So, yes, I've been involved in public companies that way, but I was a broker for a while. So I understand the capital markets from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I've been a founder of a startup company, all those things, you mash it all together. And, theoretically you should have a little bit more skill set than the average investor.
And I'm going to frame a few of these next questions through the lens of you as a CEO when looking to invest in these businesses. The first question I have for any of these microcap companies is, if you're so small, and again, like we'll define small, I think you look for like 30 million or less, if that's correct, at least according to like a recent presentation I saw. It may be, maybe more now. Let's say like 30 to 50 million or less. What is the reason that some of these companies are public when their market caps are almost so small where it just doesn't like intuitively make sense for them to be public?
Yeah. I think we run into a lot of those situations where you go, okay, this makes zero sense for you guys to be public, but more times than not, that's not the way it started, right? That's kind of where they are at now. they may have gone public, an investment banker may have convinced them that this is the best thing since sliced bread, and this is how they're going to generate all the capital they needed. And then there's hiccups and, a long story as to why they get to be where they are. I run up against that a lot of times where you see these great little businesses and, I've actually invested in some public companies that have a $2 million market cap. It's that low. There, when you listen to the history, it's typically, this isn't the way we expected it to be. But here they are, and the cost of going private is too high a hurdle. And they're just challenged to sort of keep doing what they're doing and sort of eat the higher expenses of being a public company and hope one day that they can grow into something bigger. I mean, one of my biggest wins is a company called Expel. And when I found Expel Technologies, I think they had a $6 or $7 million market cap. That's what is it now? It's a $1 billion market cap, or at least it was earlier this year. So these companies, you kind of think, look at them, and you say, okay, why? But sometimes they'll tell you in a few years why.
So what was the why for Expel?
Well, okay, so again, this seems to be a common denominator for a lot of the companies that I find that end up doing well. They go to market, they go either do an IPO or up here in Canada, you do a lot of what's called reverse takeovers. And they go public, they raise a bunch of money, and then something doesn't go right. So they may go to public with a $25 to $50 million market cap, but something goes wrong and they have to pivot or whatever. And that's what happened with Expel. They had to really pivot from what their original business plan was. And got down to this nano cap valuation Had to really come in and change management. That extremely good management team came in and pivoted the business like it should, and then it just kept hitting home runs, right? And it became what it was. That is very common with a lot of the companies that I've been successful with, where they raise a bunch of money, they get listed, something doesn't go quite as according to plan, they have to rejig, repivot, and most of them fail, but the ones that are successful and turned into real business, they turn into these multi-baggers that everybody's looking for.
And you mentioned something interesting where the cost of going private is higher than what I would assume to be the ongoing cost of staying public. Mm-hmm. And so you almost have this like switching cost dilemma, which I didn't necessarily consider when I first thought about it. Mm-hmm. If you were to guess as a percentage of revenue, and again, this might just be, mm-hmm. kind of a question that you can't answer, but if you were to guess as a percentage of revenue, how much of a cost burden is staying public, let's say for on the OTC markets or like the Canadian, whether it's the venture exchange or some other exchange?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So it's quite different on the OTC than it is in Canada. In Canada, sort of the venture market, we've now got sort of two venture markets in Canada, but the cost is always, it was always sort of, the exchange was built to have lower costs for these real small startups and right. sort of publicly listed venture companies.
Yep.
And to the fact that like in Canada, we've got a sort of almost an immature venture capital market. So the real way you get capital is by going public a lot earlier than they do in the States. But the cost, I'd say really at bare minimum, you're looking at costs of being public and that $150,000 to $250,000 sort of really on the bottom end per year. And theoretically it comes with some advantages, right? So you're able to do partial sales of your positions and things like that. There's a little liquidity for founders and things like that. So there's a bit of an offset there, but yeah, you're looking at about $150,000 to $250,000 on the Canadian side to be listed. As you graduate to a bigger exchange, whether it's NASDAQ or TSX, those numbers balloon up and they go up by 10 or 20 times. So it's very, very different.
So an XPEL at the $6 million market cap is potentially spending like 3.5 to 5% of its revenue just to stay public.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's nuts.
And remember, it's worse than that because it's all bottom line, right? If that expense is gone, it's hitting the bottom line. So yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of sort of come to Jesus moments in these boardrooms where they sit there and say, okay, we're spending this kind of money to be public. The market's not giving us a valuation that we think we deserve. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to do something about it and go private. But then the other thing is like just the legal costs and the costs of taking it private. There's other costs associated with it as well, because you don't know what it's going to cost you to actually take it private. You don't know if you're going to get enough shareholders to be willing to tender to any kind of go private bid or anything like that. So it could be significantly costlier than that. And sometimes it doesn't justify it, but maybe it's the part of the pool I'm swimming in, but there's a lot of companies that I tend to talk to and they're always kind of questioning whether they should do it or not, because more times than not it's the fact that the market is not giving the valuation that they're seeing in this private space.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to pivot to an area that I think differentiates yourself from almost every microcap investor, which is your familiarity and use of CanSlim, which for those that don't know, it's William O'Neill's, famous. I don't even know what they stand for, I guess.
I can try to remember it. If you want me to try to go through it, it's been a while since I've read it.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's like, I know CanSlim exists. I kind of know what it's about. I think I read the book at one point, but anyways, what fascinates me about this is I get CanSlim for highly liquid names, right? Because you are using some sort of technical analysis, new highs, and we'll get into all that. But when you're working with microcaps and illiquid names, part of me is like, why and how could a technical approach work with some of these very highly illiquid names? Where, like you said, like the bid ask could be, 20 to 40% swings between the two.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've tweaked the CANSLIM so it kind of fits a more Canadian model. And you're right, for the kind of size companies that I go after, you can't really use technical analysis. You can to some degree, like really, when it comes to technicals, anyways, the way I use them in the microcap space, it's not so much to, it's a sense of timing. Like, you know, the old adage, fundamentals tells you what to buy, technicals tell you when to buy it.
Right.
I would tweak it a little bit by saying, when it comes to microcaps, technicals tell you how to buy it, right? So if you really like the fundamentals in a stock and it's in a downtrend, that tells you you're probably going to have an easier time buying the stock. You're going to have, you know, you can be a little bit more patient trying to pick up a position. But if a stock's starting to move and starting to move quickly and it's starting to break 52 week highs and things like that, then you got to be a little bit more active, right? You got to be faster to the buy and things like that. So the technical component, I've tweaked it to sort of meet my needs.
And so when you said you gave it kind of the Canadian twist, what did that look like?
Well, I mean, a few things. First off, my experience as being in the industry of being a broker and sort of in the investment banking side and things like that has helped me to understand where the players are in the industry. So meaning, like in Canada, most of the institutions or sort of funds really don't touch a microcap until it gets to at bare minimum $50 million market cap, right? So understanding that, I know that anything below $50 million market cap, that's my sandbox, right? I'm not going to really get much competition from institutional players. So I keep that in mind. So when I'm tweaking it, you know, the true CANSLIM sort of strategy, you're looking at stocks that are $10 or higher, right? And you're looking for some institutional ownership, not a lot, right? When you really sort of live by the actual details. In Canada, if you did that, you'd be too late, right? I mean, predominantly most microcaps here trade at 50 cents, so you're not gonna see it at $10 until it's too late. And if you got an institution that's already buying it, it's kind of, in Canada, it's kind of, you're already late to the game. So I tweak that. Like I said, you know, really what I want to do is I want to buy, you know, forget the $10 price tag. I'm just going to buy anything that's got a market cap 50 million or lower. You know, fully understanding that sort of where you are in the food chain.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. And walk us through actually how you stumbled upon the CANSLIM method and adding technical analysis. Cause it is a pretty cool story. Part of my research before this recording was, I went back and listened to your episode with Tobias Carlyle, and it was a fantastic episode. And I was like, man, how do I add value to this conversation? But walk us through how you ended up incorporating technicals into your approach.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'll tell you how I even stumbled on the book, right? Because it's one of the books. I mean, there's a handful of books that actually have changed my life, and that is one of the books that have changed my life. I joined the financial side. So, I mean, I thought I was good at investing. I started real young, read as many books as I could and everything from, you know, Ben Graham and you name it, Peter Lynch, everything. So I entered a stock picking contest, and there was, I don't know, 500, 1,000 people that were in this contest. And I think I came in like 30th, right? I can't remember the exact number, but I did okay. And the premise was you've got this $100,000 portfolio, play portfolio, and you trade for 6 months. And at the end of the thing, whoever won got a $100,000 prize. And it was sponsored by a brokerage firm. So here I am coming in 30th out of, you know, however many people are in it. And I'm thinking I'm just this fantastic investor. And what happened was the guy who came in first was interviewed on TV. And not only did he come in first, but like the difference between first and second place, he was on a different planet, right? Yeah. He just blew everybody out of the water. And when they interviewed him, they said, "What's your strategy?" And he said, "Well, I just bought anything that was hitting a 52 Kai that was trading close to a dollar. And I'm kind of waiting for the rest of the answers." And they said, "That's it. That's all I did, right?" And so the interviewer said, "How did you come up with that?" And he said, "Well, I read this book called How to Make Money in Stocks by William O'Neill, and here's the strategy, right?" Of course, as soon as I heard that, within an hour, I think I had the book in my hand, and sort of everything changed after that. So it was that's how I found out about CANSLIM, and then really what happened was I read the book probably three times over, and I started putting it to practice. And it blew me away. It absolutely blew me away. My first year, the returns, I'm not talking like 20, 30% returns. I was getting 300, 400% returns. Like it was crazy.
Yeah.
And at one point, by then I had become a broker, and I went through this exercise. Every week I would find a stock that fit the canceling criteria. So anything in the sort of North American universe.
Yep.
And so every week I'd come up with a new name. And at this point I was sending out these little sort of faxes to clients and potential clients. And I'd come up with a new name every week, just based on this criteria. And by the end of that year, if my picks had been a fund, we would have been the best performing fund in North America. It was that crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah. Do you have specific examples from those early applications of the Cancelum method, like specific companies, or maybe just like some early kind of eye opener? Yeah. Wow. I can't believe that I actually took this from the book and put it to practice.
Sure. So, one of the first ones, and I can say this was the biggest eye opener, also probably one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made, but there's a company called Bowflex. I don't know if you're familiar with
Is that Bowflex. The exercise equipment company?
Yes, it's the exercise equipment. There's so many lessons I learned from that company, but we were, I was buying it around 80 cents, 90 cents. This company was growing 100% a year. It was trading at 8x earnings. It was, it basically had all the criteria except for, like I said, that $10 magic price, and there was no institutional ownership, stuff like that. I think within a year and a half, the stock was at $11, right? So it was this, 10, 12 bagger in this really short period of time. And of course, being relatively new to this game, what you do is, as an early investor, is you buy as much as you can when you find it. And when it goes up, you sell it. That's kind of what you do, right?
Just that easy.
That easy, right? And but lo and behold, it didn't stop at $11. It didn't stop at 12. It didn't stop at 20. I think ultimately it went up to $250, something like that. So I'd left an egregious amount of money on the table off a pick like that. So that was one. There's another company called Medifast. I actually looked it up. It's still around. I bought that stock at 24 cents. I think it's trading at $160 right now. This was a long time ago, but the process was what I was understanding, and the validation that it's working. And I can go on. I mean, there's so many companies that I own that have gone up 10, 20, 100 times in value. The problem I had early on was, again, I didn't have, I mean, go over and over again. I didn't have the business plan. I didn't have the strategy. I knew how to find them. I didn't know how to hold them, right? I didn't know how to sell them, which is something, another skill set you got to learn all over again. So,
and when you were selling those stocks, what you would call prematurely, mm-hmm. what were your sell rules? Was it just, if it hits X percent return, I'm happy and I get out? Was it a technical sell setup? Like what was the thought process?
I was stupid. Like there was no sell process, right? It was, okay, this is up. I'm excited. So many of the lessons I supposedly learned early were, in experience, they're so wrong, right? You hear everything from, sell half when it doubles, balance your portfolio, don't let anything become more than 5% of your, all that sort of stuff. That, like, if, if you're going to play in the microcap space, you got to, I heard your interview with Christian the other day, you got to water your flowers and cut the weeds, right? Yep. When you have a winner, you hold on for dear life. That's it. My sell process has morphed a little bit now where, if something gets egregiously overvalued, and I've got my criteria in terms of what really that looks like, and it's sort of based on a PEG ratio type of valuation, if you know what that is. Or really what motivates me to sell something is that I got to find something better, right? And part of what I love about this business is I'm always on the hunt for the next best deal. So mm-hmm. if I can find something better than something I've got in my portfolio, I'm going to trade it out, but it has to really, really, give me conviction that it's a better deal than something I already own.
Yeah. And that better deal, is it just some sort of like 3 to 5 year projected IRR? Like, how do you determine that?
Oh, I'm terrible at projecting out any kind of thing in the future. So the margin of safety type of approach, you want to find deals. If I can find something that's growing 40, 50% a year, that's trading at single digit price earnings ratios, that have been doing it for a couple of years, you know, those are the sort of things that I really gravitate towards. And I mean, it's so difficult. I mean, there's so many analysts out there that are trying to predict what the next 2-3 years look like. And for goodness sakes, I mean, look what we've had in the last 2-3 years. Nobody's been able to predict anything.
Yep.
So for me, it's just, you know, find something that's cheap, that is growing, cross your fingers, hold on for dear life, you know, sacrifice a chicken, whatever it takes, just, you know, wait it out. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But when it works, boy, oh boy, it works well.
Yeah, I think that's a great segue into this next bulk of the conversation, which I've titled Cheapies with a Chance. And the reason I did that is because I think it was 2020, you did a presentation for Bobby Kraft and the Stock News Network, highlighting your process. And so I want to spend the rest of most of this, rest segment going through your process soup to nuts, and then identifying and walking through a few examples that you highlighted in that presentation, actual businesses that kind of met that criteria and generated those returns. So let's really kind of unpack this and again, go soup to nuts. And like from the beginning of the process, what does your initial filtering screening tools look like, and what gets you excited about going further in a business?
Okay, sure. So what I do is I go through CDAR filing. So, you guys have Edgar and 10Ks and things like that. So I do the same thing up here in Canada, but I do it manually, right? And I've got a partner that I work with that helps me out quite a bit now, but it's literally going through filings and looking for a basic criteria to sort of do the first screen. So I don't use any software screening. I found that in the past that you end up missing one or two, you know, a few will fall between the cracks. And that's actually the ones you want, because if everybody's using the screening software and one gets through it and they can't find it, well, you're kind of missing the real ones you want, right? You want to get it before everybody else does. So it's all manual. So I'm going through these financials and I want to see a minimum 25% revenue growth, right? Sort of on a share basis. So meaning like not strictly through M&A, it's mostly organic. So I'm looking for that sort of first barrier that it's got to get over. And then once I sort of get that, now I'm looking for profitability. If I can see a company that's turned a profit, then it's sort of now it's gone to the next level. And if I can see it's kind of put two quarters of profitability together, now I'm getting more excited, right? Because, almost any company can get lucky and do, you know, one good quarter, but the more consistency you have, the better. And then you kind of want to look back and you're looking at some other things that are a little bit less important, but I want to see a trend of revenue growth, right? So maybe they were losing money last year, but still revenues have been growing for the last 3-4 years or whatever the number. I don't care so much about the balance sheet. Balance sheets are easy to fix. I actually prefer in some ways if the balance sheet's a little wonky. I really invest on the income statement. There's been cases where, you know, a company's had a fantastic income statement, but the balance sheet needs some help. And that's actually an opportunity for us. I'll go in and say, look, you need a financing, clean up your balance sheet. That's how I can get my position. And we'll finance the company. So we did that. We did that with a company called Hamilton Thorne. We were able to finance, great income statement, but they had some debt that they wanted to get rid of. So we financed it at 10 cents. This is about 4 or 5 years ago. The stock trades very consistently now around $1.60, $1.70. So that was a massive win for us because of the balance sheet. And then other things we look for, you know, we're going to look for share structure, that's something that's pretty important to us. I can go into why we look at that. We want to see insider ownership that's meaningful. Even at that, there's some things you got to be aware of. That's the bulk of it. I'd say, you know, what I've just mentioned here is probably 90% of what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And everything else just incrementally adds a little bit more safety to it.
When you look at the profitability or even year-over-year revenue growth, right? Like let's start there. Why the year over year, as opposed to, let's say, like a 2 to 3 year CAGR of 25% to give you a little bit more durability? Like, are you trying to capture maybe inflection points in a business?
Yeah. So that's a key thing. Now, it's not to say that we don't, I mean, I prefer to see 3-4 years of good solid CAGR, right?
Right.
But what we're trying to do is we're trying to catch it early, right? In some cases, like we don't, this is one of the things I've changed really from early on. I don't go in and say, okay, I love this business, so I'm going to put my whole position in place right now, right? Mm. No, I'm going to get a starter position in it. And then as they execute, so if they've only gotten 2 quarters of profitability, you know, if I see a third or fourth, maybe that's when I, you know, execute more capital into the company.
Yeah.
So the more sort of evidence I see that these guys are on track, the more conviction I'm going to have. But in some cases, you want to try to get it early and just pay attention. So we prefer to see a long tail of profitability. But if it's 2 quarters, that gets us started.
Yeah. And then on the growth, I would assume that coming out of COVID, the list must have exploded because so many companies benefited from that year over year COVID bump. And so how difficult did you find it to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff at that point in time when everybody's year over year numbers looked incredible?
Well, it really depended on the industry you're in, because some looked incredible and some looked absolutely disastrous. That was hard. That was really hard. We saw a lot of businesses where you sat there and said, okay, if this pandemic, okay, nobody knew how long the pandemic was going to go, right? If the pandemic stays like this for a while, these businesses are going to do really well. And then others, you thought, okay, this is too crazy. And then you got to use a little bit of, you know, sort of business 101 understanding. You know, if there's a shortage of masks or a shortage of a certain type of product, you know that, you know, the capital system is built, so you're going to have a lot more supply coming. And at some point, the pricing and the margins are going to disappear.
Right.
So we didn't really modify sort of the portfolio too much. We wanted to find businesses that we thought were going to do well in or out of the pandemic. Now, we were fortunate that we actually owned some businesses that were really able to take advantage of the pandemic and saw some crazy numbers and were able to finance at some high valuations. I find that if you keep it simple, if you buy stuff that's cheap, whatever the world sort of throws at you, it's amazing how lucky you end up getting. Some of these businesses just sort of walk into success because of what the world does. It's just buy something cheap and you'd be shocked at how lucky you get.
Yeah. I mean, so many ills can be forgiven if you buy at a cheap enough price. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the beauty of it. You mentioned airtight share structure. That's something that's really important to me when I look at these smaller cap names, is just, and that's actually partially why I kind of balked a bit when you said you don't necessarily look at the balance sheet, but maybe there's that bifurcation between the assets and liabilities versus the equity. Because if I see a very convoluted equity statement where there's, you know, Class A, B, C, preferreds, all these, you know, weird warrant units, and it just it kind of turns me off about the business. So maybe that's what you mean with an airtight share structure, where it's like, look, we got one share class, we got the common, got 5 million shares outstanding, like we're not issuing anymore. This is what it is, and then makes things real simple.
Yeah, simple is better, right? You know, the KISS principle. So what we found historically, I don't know what the magic reason for this is, but traditionally, if we see a company that's got sort of sub 50 million shares outstanding and you know, not a lot of, call it options or warrants or any kind of convertible features or anything like that, it's shocking how we find a higher sort of percentage of companies that are profitable that have a small share structure than those that have a bigger share structure. And that shouldn't be the case, right? It shouldn't matter how many shares are outstanding, whether a company's profitable or not, but it's an odd circumstance we find. And what we think it's the reason for it is that if a management team, you know, is sort of tight with their shares, if they're not out constantly diluting their share structure, they tend to sort of use their other resources in the same fashion, right? They're going to be tight with their cash. They're going to be tight with their resources. They're going to treat all their resources similar to how they treat their shares. So we find that for whatever reason, we're just luckier with our returns, and we find companies that are, you know, manage their share count like they do every other resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember a couple of years ago, maybe a few years ago, I was researching this UK-based microcap company, and they had 1 billion shares.
Mm-hmm.
1 billion. And I just, like, immediately that should have been a red flag and should have made me stop. But for some reason, I just like gawked at it. I'm like, oh my gosh, like 1 billion shares. It's just unfathomable.
Yeah. Well, up here in Canada, we had a lot of cannabis companies go public, right? And the investment bankers were throwing money at these guys. So they just kept taking it and taking it. And they got addicted to just easy money. These companies that had issued so many shares and hundreds of millions of shares, you find that after this sort of the cash, the easy cash stops flowing in, they're left trying to run their business, and they just don't have the right attitude, right? It's everything was coming easy, cash was being thrown at them, and now they're trying to run a business and generate cash, and lo and behold, most of them are down 80-90%. So
when you look at trying to find these names, you mentioned that it's just straight up A through Z looking at, I think you said Cedar filings.
Yeah.
Have you thought about running any like super high level screens where it's just market cap and liquidity based, or just market cap and industry, and then just going maybe one through one? Or do you do manual because the financial data for these like really small companies doesn't necessarily translate into like a conventional screener?
Yeah. So I think it's just now that it's such common practice for me. I can sort of do it in seconds and go through it where I never really trusted. Part of it is just, I didn't trust the software to come up with the data that I needed to see.
Right.
So, and maybe it's better now, but I'm too old to sort of change. So I'll keep doing it, and it's worked. So why fix it if it's not broken?
Right. Now, if we were to invert your soup to nuts process on kind of what you look for, you know, whether it's growth, profitability, size, what are some immediate red flags where when you're scrolling through that A to Z list, you see it and it's just, you know, boom, no, done, on to the next one?
There's lots of things like that. You know, it's just an expanding share count, right? That's an easy one for us. You see, they're able to grow their revenues, but it's because it's just you keep acquiring businesses and they can't really, you know, there's not a lot of logic to it as a shareholder. I've seen a lot of companies where it happens a lot in the resource space where, you know, somebody's resume is going to say that, you know, I grew this business from a $10 million market cap to $200 million. What they forget to tell you is they just diluted it up to 200 million, right? The share price never went anywhere. So that happens a lot, right, in microcap space. So, you know, that's a red flag. The red flags usually show up sort of kind of after you've done your big screening. You're finding out that, you know, the CEO salary is a little bit too high for the size of the company. There's way too many options or, you know, other convertible structures within the company that aren't exactly shareholder friendly. So that's usually where the red flags, you got to dig a little deeper for those.
And so when you're going from, let's say, you know, step one to step two, where you found a company that kind of meets that initial criteria, what are the next few things that you do to determine like, hey, this might be, you know, I know it's tongue in cheek, but like, you know, we're all trying to find the next X-Bell basically. Mm-hmm. So like, what are you looking for? What are you trying to suss out? Whether it's questions to management, digging through filings, talking to customers, vendors, like what do those next steps look like?
So, you know, we don't do as much of the sort of the calling of clients and things like that. Like what I really, really believe in is if you do your work right, the financials are going to tell you a lot of things that humans are not going to tell you, right? So yeah. I find financials rarely lie. Humans tend to at least boast or, you know, exaggerate a little bit. So you got to be a little cautious. I usually own my position, or at least a starter position, before I talk to management. A lot of times if I speak to management, I hear something I don't like, I'll sell, right?
Yeah.
So I tend to have my position. And the other thing that having a position in advance does is it actually makes me work harder, makes me do more due diligence once I own it rather than before I own it. So, so we do that, but I do, I do try to, you know, call management. I do try to do some of that sort of periphery due diligence. And, but some of the things I'm looking for are not what the, what I think the average investor is looking for. So I want to call up a company and I want to, you know, usually what I'll ask is, you know, can I speak to somebody who handles investor relations? And I love it when the receptionist goes, that she has no idea what that means, right? She doesn't get investor calls, right? The company barely has people investors calling. I love it when I hear that. And things like that. And then when I am talking to CEO, I don't want him to have 2 hours for me. You know, I want him to have 10 minutes at best, and he's busy because he's got, you know, sales calls and things like that. So I'm looking for common sense stuff that that probably the average investor gets, you know, is not really where. I hearken back to Expel. This is great. You know, so many things that I've learned from Expel, but when I stumble on Expel, I had built a really sizable position before I got a hold of the CEO or anybody at management. And I remember I was excited about this business because the numbers are just so outstanding and this is cool technology. And I had actually introduced it to two of my friends who were brokers. And, you know, they went through their sort of process of checking to the company, but they refused to buy any shares until they could talk to management. The problem was management are extremely busy, right? And they weren't able to get back to their, you know, back to some of these calls for like 3-4 weeks, in some cases for months. So these guys never touched the stock and were turned off by it, right? So here you have one of the best performing stocks in history and somebody gets turned off because CEO is too busy generating business, right?
Yeah.
You got to understand. And this is where, you know, having been a CEO and been involved in that sort of side of it, it gave me a little bit better view on what was likely happening.
Now, if you don't get an answer from the CEO, will you try to find like the CFO or some sort of other executive to kind of pick their brain just wait for the CEO to call back?
Yeah. I track somebody down, like sooner or later, they'll get tired of me. Yeah, the receptionist will get me in front of the janitor or somebody that's at the business for sure. I do hundreds of interviews. That's actually one of the things I do with Smokeout Discoveries is we do regular interviews with CEOs and management teams. And I've done hundreds and hundreds of these and I can kind of speak their language and understand what they're really saying. So it is important that I talk to somebody there. And I've talked to everybody from, you know, the CEO down to the head of sales or, you know, maybe the director, chairman or things like that. I try to get somebody and I actually try to get different views of the business from different players. So it's not just the CEO I'm hearing from.
I'm going to go through kind of a lightning round of examples of some of these, you know, Expel like companies or just companies that have kind of passed the screeners, passed the tests and were qualified for investment for you guys. Again, it's kind of four names. And so with each of these names, just walk us through what made you interested, what you liked about it, why it passed all your filters and then what you thought, you know, maybe it, the competitive advantage of the business or, you know, just really what attracted you to the investment as a whole. And so we'll start with the first one. It is Senko Tech.
Okay, so Senko Tech, it's changed its name since then. It's called Namesys now. What I loved about it, you're going to find this will be common denominator for all these. What I liked was the numbers, right? In some cases, I buy the stock before I actually really even know what they do, right? If the numbers are there, if they're doing the right things, I don't care if they've got a better product than somebody else. The market, like the business is telling me that, right? You know, it's having run a business, I know how hard it is to generate a profit. I know how hard it is to grow a business, right? So I'm not an expert. In this case, they sell software for cash management, right? Immediately, one of the things you're going to think is, okay, cash. Well, cash is going the way to the dodo bird, right? I mean, everybody's going to be using credit cards. Everybody's going to use Bitcoin or, you know, Alipay or whatever you want to pick. But the reality is that the numbers were telling something different. And when you really do your homework down the road, you find out that there's more cash, physical cash in existence now than ever in the, you know, since the beginning of time. So there's a real need for that, but you wouldn't have known that if you really didn't dive into the business and understand the numbers. So for me, I bought that stock at 5 cents. It was, you know, like all these other ones, it was growing its revenues over 25% a year. It was nicely profitable. It put more than two quarters together of profitability. It was trading at like 6 or 7 times earnings, very illiquid, too small for institutional investors. It was just tiny, tiny, tiny. I think about 3 years later, 4 years later, something like that, I was selling at $1.20. So it was a good solid win for me. Again, I owned a sizable position before I ever got a hold of anybody at the company. And that was a company that was actually very difficult to get a hold of anybody there. So which is not uncommon with a lot of the big wins I've had, is these companies are not out there promoting themselves and they're not out there having a lot of investor relations calls.
Yeah, that's something that's like on the surface you would view, and I've viewed this at times as a red flag, where it's like, oh, if management's, you know, so dodgy with my calls and not willing to take my calls and answer my questions, like maybe that's because that they're hiding something, yada, yada, yada. And I guess you can kind of spin it any way you'd like, but there is kind of that reality of maybe that's just them trying to do the best job they can at being CEO, and they just don't really value an outside call right now at this point versus trying to make their business better.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of my process to understand why they might not be calling me back. Like, it is, you know, I'll talk to reception and say, hey, look, I left a call last week. Is there a reason why, you know, he's not calling back? And if it's, you know, he's traveling on business, or he's promised me he's going to give you a call back. And so there, you try to mitigate a little bit, but listen, I've had the flip side. Like, I've actually talked to management teams, and there was one case where it was actually the chairman of the board of the company. He was trying to convince me basically not to buy the stock. Like, I had never seen this before, where a management team was almost out there telling me, look, just don't buy the stock. It's, you know, we could be in trouble. We could be this, we could be that. I've just done this too often. When I hear that sort of stuff, my spidey senses sort of tingle, and I go, okay, there's something more to it. And sure enough, there was. It was in his best interest to keep the share price a little bit quiet until a certain transaction happened, and then lo and behold, the stock just went crazy. So experience in this business can be pretty valuable sometimes.
Yep. So you had Senko Tech, and what was the market cap when you first invested, and then what was the market cap when you exited?
God. Yeah, so that's another one that was probably a sub $5 million market cap. I don't
recall. That's on the Canadian exchange, right?
This is on the Canadian exchange. Yeah. Okay. So Canadian dollars. So that's like nothing in US dollars, right? I'm going to say, I think when I exited, it was probably about a $40 million market cap, somewhere around there.
That's not bad. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the next one. Excelaware. Same thing.
Okay. So this was a little crazy. So, one of the things we do is we've got this thing called Cheapies with a Chance. And we do that twice a year, where instead of sort of looking at filings on a daily basis, we actually go through the whole system of filing in Canada. So we go literally from A to Z, and we try to find any companies that usually are sort of sub almost $10 million market cap, but they have something going for them. Either they have a real good balance sheet, and maybe they're losing a little bit of money, or they've got a, you know, good income statement, bad balance sheet, or it could be a combination of those things. But like, we don't look at anything above $10 million, and it's got to have something that gets us excited. Maybe some hidden value or something like that. So Excelware was a company that it was a 2 cent stock. I'm going to say it was another probably $2 or $3 million market cap company, but they had this really novel technology that would allow oil extraction from tar sands in a way that has never been done before. And they were making some money through consulting. And we felt this was one of those opportunities where sort of the base business was worth more than the current market cap, but there was some optionality in the IP they had. And lo and behold, they make an announcement, and literally the stock went from 2 cents to 40 cents in a day. So we had this sort of 20 bagger in a day. I think since then the stock's gone up to about 80 cents. It's pulled back a bit, but So that was just one of these crazy little valuations that we found, that we call it cheapies with a chance, because these market caps in some cases are sort of the value of a shell, like a publicly listed shell that has no business. You're able to buy these things with a business, and you might get lucky now and then, and certainly with that one we did.
Wow. So that, again, like less than $10 million market cap, less than $5 million, you said. Potentially that's crazy. So how long does it take you to like accumulate a position like that, like an Excelware?
Some get real easy, right? I had another company, it was during the pandemic, actually just before the pandemic. It was a 1.5 to 2 cent stock. They were kind of flirting with break even. They were making a little bit of money here and losing a little bit of money there. And, And it was just a stock that I think a lot of people just kind of given up on. And it's amazing when a stock sort of flatlines at that level for a while. If you were to bid a half a penny higher, it's amazing how much stock you can get from some impatient investors. So this other deal was a case just like that. I think I picked up 2 or 3 million shares around that price point. And then lo and behold, COVID hits, and they've got a technology that, I don't know if you remember what cytokine storm was, but this, you get these sort of fibrosis of the lungs. And they had a stem cell technology that all of a sudden applied for that. And there's another case where in like 2-3 days, the stock went from 2 cents to like 40 cents, I think it was. So we got lucky, but it's, you've got to play at that end of the pool, and you know, more times than not, you're not going to make any money on it, but you've got to know that there's some potential inflection point. There's some hidden value or optionality that you can pick up for nothing.
Yep. Third company, Inventronics.
Okay. So this is a lot more standard to kind of what we look for. This was a very, very small share count. I think they still have about 4.5 million shares outstanding. I think it was around 30 cents when we found it. So I can't even do the math. I think that's about $1.5 million market cap when we found it. But this company just, they were putting numbers out there. I think this was growing at 40-50% a year. I was trading at 3 or 4 times earnings. And they just another quarter, and just kept doing it. And it's a really boring business. They make casings for telecommunications equipment. So we've all seen these things. We've driven by them. They're these metal cases that that house some sort of telecom equipment. And you get lucky because you own some of these stuff cheap, but it really started to happen with some logistics issues around the world where their competitors that were producing these things in China couldn't get product shipped. And so they were getting clients all over the place. Now they've been able to retain those clients, and you know, the stocks, I think it hit over $2, but I think it trades around $1.70, $1.80. So it's that's been a really good win for us now.
Wow. And that sounds like one of those hidden champion businesses where it's a really small cog for these telecom companies. And so you can just like pretty much name your price. What were some of the margin structures for these businesses? Like, did you kind of have a target, like, you know, profit margin, like, hey, we like, you know, companies that make, you know, 10, 15 plus profit margins, or was it just as long as they had profitability? Didn't necessarily.
Yeah. So it's more that, more the second part, as long as they have profitability, we don't get too anchored in sort of the, you know, the gross margins or profit margins. Clearly we want to see the higher, the better, but you don't discount them because of sort of their level. They are what they are. If they're going to generate cash, and grow, you're going to do well, right? And one of the things you mentioned, sort of one of the things we really love, we believe there's riches and niches, right? And more times than not, we want to own businesses that dominate a niche rather than are going to go out and get 1% of, you know, this multi-billion-dollar business, because the competitors are just going to crush it for that 1%, where, you know, if the niche is too small, you're not going to get major competitors.
Yeah. And that's kind of like also begs a question. It's how big or small of a niche do you have for a company that's $2 to $10 million market cap to kind of dominate that space, right? Because intuitively you would think, oh, if a company's that small, there's no way they're the clear market leader in that segment, because the clear market leader would have a larger market cap, better resources, more visibility, yada, yada, yada. But that's, I guess, kind of the catch all. It's like, if you're trying to find the next XPEL or the next big winner, you have to identify these really small businesses that are actually doing really well in a very small portion of their market.
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, if they're able to grow at 25% a year or greater, right? Usually that's a niche you want to be in, because it's a growing niche. And what happens more times than not, and XPEL has been a good example of this as well, is you dominate a niche and then you move into another one. You sort of grow into another niche, or you take on another product, and lo and behold, you know, this all of a sudden is not a niche anymore, right?
Yep.
I mean, XPEL, when I'd never heard of paint protection film when I first stumbled on this company, and I thought, my God, this is a niche. I mean, I've never seen the product. So, you know, how big could this be? Well, we found out how big it could be, right? It's so significantly bigger than, I don't think anybody's calling it a niche anymore, right? But it was.
Yeah. Yep. And then finally, we'll do, I think it's Posabit or Posabit.
Posabit, yeah. So, So Posabit is a, it's basically a point of sale system for the cannabis space. And, you know, the cannabis space has a lot of challenges. You know, in some jurisdictions now, you can pay with credit cards, but a lot of businesses in a lot of areas, you have to pay by cash, and you have to have, it all had to be sort of regulated and taken care of, and it had its own issues. So it was a niche that rapidly exploded sort of based on the issues around that and sort of the legality around it. Same thing, this was another Cheapies with a Chance that we found. I think we found it around, I say 17 cents, something like that. It was growing very rapidly. I don't think they were quite profitable or they were break even when we found them, but, you know, growing at, if I remember correctly, 80, 90% a year. And we knew they had something, but the market cap was so cheap. Again, it was this sub $10 million market cap. I think that stock hit, I'm going to say $1.10, or no, it's trading around $1.10 right now. So it was significantly higher than that. So that was a nice 5-8 bagger win as well.
And Posabit, so they would compete with, like, if I'm getting this right, like Leafly and those types of companies, or even a what's the ticker symbol? Maps. I think it's like WM Technologies.
Oh right, yeah. I think now it's, I mean, the industry is going to be a little more mainstream. So I think that there's a lot more competition. It's probably a little bit harder for this type of business. But again, I don't really get, it's too hard for me to do all the work and try and really understand where they stand in the competitive landscape. I really want to see the numbers continue to grow. And if they stop growing the way I wanted to see them grow, then I know there's an issue, right? I'm going to know that more than I'm going to, or yep, sooner than I'm going to know that some competitors are going to eat their lunch.
Yeah. And I guess the other kind of corollary to that is, if these things are so small and they're growing so fast, you potentially have a chance to just, you know, get an equity stub on something that's going to get acquired by some of these other larger players that come into the market, where they find a niche player that's growing, that's profitable, that they can pay, you know, 5 to 7 times, you know, EBIT, or you know, 10 to 12 times profits for that business. And that's a huge win for the small company. And it's just kind of another day for the larger roll up.
You know, we see it all the time. We had another acquisition, you know, where we're sort of sleepy, quiet companies get acquired about 6-7 months ago. That happens all the time. And it is an exit strategy for some, and some sort of fix that sort of go private issue when you get a big competitor coming to buy you. So it happens all the time. Again, it's got to be common sense, right? If these are valued right, you'd be shocked at how often you get acquired by a bigger player.
If you look at your evolution as an investor since you started, you know, going back before the Canslim method, adding your Canadian Canslim method, and just honing in on this microcap niche, what are some ways or things that, if you were to go back and do it all over again, what would you do more of? What would you do less of, and why?
I mean, early on, I was young, I was impatient. I thought whatever the shiny object in front of me was going to be the last, you know, great investment, the opportunity I was ever going to have. I think I'm way more patient now. I think that's a critical component of being a good investor. You almost have to be boring, right? Good investors are boring, right? But I think one of the things that early on, I didn't know where my niche was, right? I didn't know exactly where I wanted to play. And my recommendation to any young investors that I talk to now is really get to know yourself, right? Understand what your personality is, and then build a strategy around that personality. And then really, you know, like anything else, get good at it, practice it, you know, treat this like a business if you want it to perform like a business, and get good at that niche, right? If I want to go up market and go play in the big boys and the large caps, I'm competing with Joel Greenblatt, the Warren Buffett of the world. I'm just never going to win that. I just don't have what they have, right? But in the microcap space, I can compete, right? I can go toe to toe with a lot of guys there, and quite frankly, you know, a lot of good investors graduate out of the microcap space, right? So you know, what have I learned? I've really learned to be patient, hone your skills, treat this like a business, and really at the end, then stay in your lane, right? somebody wants to take my advice on, futures or, currency, bonds and whatnot, I'm just not going to give them the right answer. So I'm not going to bother.
Now, if you could distill all of your investment principles and kind of guiding philosophies and what you look for, if you could distill it into kind of one thing that mattered most, strip away everything else, and if you could only invest on, let's say, like one metric or kind of one quantitative metric, what would that one thing be?
Just one, eh?
Yeah, just one.
That's tough. So I think growth is the hardest thing to price in investing, right? So, a lot of people make money in buying value based businesses. They're buying a dollar for 50 cents type of thing, but it's easier to sort of value that, right? But I think people, when it comes to trying to value a rapidly growing business, I think they usually either extremely underprice it or they extremely overprice it. So, I focus on growth. I'm not super interested in any business that doesn't have hyper growth capability. I think that's, especially in the microcap space, that's where you make your money. So that'd be the one thing. I mean, there's so many other things you got to add to that to lessen the risk, but that's the key thing.
Right? Got it. This has been a sweet conversation, and I appreciate you letting me kind of pick your brain on your process, from start to finish and going through actual case study examples. It kind of helped crystallize some of the things that I've gained from small cap discoveries and also from your Twitter account. And kind of speaking of Twitter, where can people go to find out more about you? I know that you're, the founder of Small Cap Discoveries. So if you want to pitch that, and then you're also on Twitter, like I said, so where can people reach out?
Yeah, I say all sorts of dumb things on Twitter. So it's Paul, at Paul Andreola on Twitter. And then by all means, smallcapdiscoveries.com. If there's anybody interested in even checking it out, tell them Brandon sent you, and I'll make sure they get a chance to try it out. But those two places, you'll get bored of me pretty quick.
Awesome. And then last question I ask everybody, if you could have dinner with any person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
I had to think about this a little bit, and I imagine, when you ask that question, you probably get a lot of people talking about investors that they'd like to
meet. Yeah, which is super boring.
It is, right? I mean, especially what I find is really good investors are really boring.
There's so many more, there's so many cooler people out there.
Absolutely.
Than investors. Like, pick your best investor, and he's not as cool as Theodore Roosevelt.
Exactly, right? So I want to have dinner with somebody who was there at some masterful big moment in history. And I'm a history buff, so anything to do with history is usually where I'll gravitate towards. But the person that really stands out to me is somebody like a Winston Churchill or even Abraham Lincoln, where they're really at the epicenter of something monumental that changed the course of history. And you just imagine the thought process and some of the things that they had to deal with. So it'd be somebody along those lines.
Yeah, it makes your job as an investor or analyst seem not as stressful when you're trying to deal with emancipation or Hitler.
Exactly.
bigger problems.
Dealing with a CEO seems a lot less challenging.
Right. Well, Paul, I love your answer. And I wish you the best of luck for the rest of the year, continued success with Small Cap Discoveries, and look forward to sharing ideas as I come across some that I think would fit your criteria.
Love it. No, this has been fun. And Brandon, congratulations, and look forward to chatting again.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally, with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.